Good day, and welcome to today's live broadcast from the USDA Radio Studios in Washington, D.C., featuring the director of USDA's National Institute of Food and Agriculture, Dr. Sunny Ramaswamy, the acting administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency, Bob Perciasepe, and various guests discussing a plan to tackle issues related to honeybee health. Also joining us on the phone lines today, Dr. May Bierenbaum from the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, fourth-generation official beekeeper Zach Browning. Reporters and members of the media, if you wish to ask a question of our guest after the opening remarks, and that will include various technical experts from USDA and EPA as well, please press star 1 on your telephone touch-tone pad. It's now my pleasure to introduce Dr. Sunny Ramaswamy.
Thanks very much, Rod, and good morning, everyone. Thank you very much for joining us here this morning. And I just wanted to convey Deputy Secretary Kathleen Merrigan's regrets for not being here. She had to be called away on an emergency. She wishes she could have been here this morning. In any case, I do want to say hello to Acting Administrator Bob Perciasepe, my colleague May Bierenbaum from the University of Illinois, and Zach Browning as well. Good morning to everybody. I do want to thank Acting Administrator Bob Perciasepe and Acting EPA Assistant Administrator Jim Jones and their team at the Environmental Protection Agency in helping, you know, address this very challenging issue of honeybee health. I want to also thank the USDA experts who were involved in developing the report, some of whom are available and will be available at the end of this call to take questions. So last fall, the experts from around the country gathered to have a conversation and to assess the state of the science on honeybee health. And the report that we're releasing is the outcome of that conference. And I think in many ways it is a landmark report that is the result of that conversation. And it really represents the consensus of the scientific community on the challenges that our honeybee populations are facing and our honeybee producers are facing, and for that matter, our farmers are facing as well. The challenges are complex, and, well, as in most things biological, there is no smoking gun, per se, and the decline in the pollinator health that we have observed in recent years is truly due to a whole host of factors, including parasites and disease, genetics, poor nutrition, and pesticide exposure as well. You can't really parse any one out as being the smoking gun. And obviously it is imperative that we take action to address the factors contributing to decline in honeybees and the continuing impacts that our farmers and honeybee producers are facing as well. So, you know, it's interesting. Most people in the United States don't realize how dependent our food supply is on the health of pollinators, and not just honeybees, but other pollinators as well. Annually, for example, in the United States, between 20 and 30 billion, that's dollars of our agricultural production is dependent on pollination. And so there are many, many crops that rely on pollination. It includes crops like almonds, cucumbers, apples, blueberries, alfalfa seed, and there's a whole host of others as well that are directly dependent on pollination in order to be able to produce set fruit. And so we're truly, as humanity, we truly are dependent on honeybees and other pollinators. And so right now, the survivorship in our honeybee colonies is too low to really truly say that we can confidently meet the demands of our agricultural crops. And so the question is, how do we address such a complex challenge? It will, in our minds, it will take the all of our stakeholders, the agricultural industry, beekeepers, researchers, the federal government, and the public to play a role in being able to address such a complex, multifactorial challenge that we've got. We've already started the process with the development and release of this report. It is the product of really unprecedented collaboration, and but there is a lot of work that needs to be done yet. At the U.S. Department of Agriculture, this work of addressing this challenge that we've got is taking place on a number of fronts. We're working to improve pollinator-friendly habitats on federal lands so that beekeepers have access to good nutritional forage for their hives. Millions of federal research dollars are supporting focused research projects related to honeybee health, and this is both in my agency, the National Institute of Food and Agriculture, and my sister agency, the USDA Agricultural Research Service, as well. We are indeed, USDA is indeed conducting a national survey. This is work being done by the National Agricultural Statistics Survey and Agricultural Research Service and others to identify honeybee pests, which will guide our research and mitigation recommendations as we go forward as well. We're also, with USDA, we're also working with farmers and ranchers to integrate pollinator habitat into their lands. Just in the past 4 years, we've incorporated pollinator enhancements into conservation programs, such as environmental quality incentives program, the conservation stewardship program, and the conservation reserve program. And we're, you know, working to train our own field staff on honeybee health so that they can better support efforts on our working lands as well. So with that as an overview of the very significant challenges that we've got, and as I said at the outset, it is multiple different factors that are contributing to the challenges that we're seeing, and we're going to all have to roll up our sleeves and work together in a collaborative manner. And I do want to turn it over to my colleague, Acting Administrator Bob Perciasepe from the Environmental Protection Agency. And but before I do that, I would like to thank him and the EPA colleagues of ours and their leadership on this very important issue. Honeybee health is critical to the future of American agriculture and to the sustainability of our environment, and I look forward to working with all of you. Over to you, Mr. Perciasepe.
Okay, well, thank you. Thank you, Sonny, and let me also start by thanking everyone at USDA and also Penn State for helping convene the National Stakeholders Conference on Honeybee Health you mentioned that we had last October, and for everyone's leadership in this effort. It is, as you point out, extremely important. It's critical. It's a critical issue and affects virtually every American, whether they realize it or not. You know, bees pollinate about a third of our crops, and from almonds to broccoli to soybeans to strawberries, and you've already pointed out that that valued at almost $20 to $30 billion, but dollars. But you also can't. It's hard to value the food value that we have here and the nature of our agriculture. And for all those reasons and more, all of us got together, coming from all ranges of backgrounds, last October in the stakeholders conference to synthesize everything we know about bee health and to look for the causes that we were having in some of the pollinator declines and colony collapse. So the report that we're releasing today is a product of that stakeholder collaboration. It is an in-depth document detailing the many challenges and what our current understanding of the causes behind these declines. And most importantly, and I think this is really key, it's starting to set a course for some solutions, set the path forward. The report summarizes the general consensus that we have that the declines are likely the result of numerous interacting stressors, including poor nutrition, habitat and forage for bees, parasites, pathogens, genetic diversity, exposure to pesticides. All of these issues are coming together here, and they have to be attacked comprehensively. And I think the good news is that the report indicates there is a range of research and policy steps that we can take now to start to address these stressors. And USDA, as you've pointed out, is already taking and planning to implement a number of measures that can help with habitat and nutrition, parasites and pathogens, and management of genetic diversity. But I also like to take a couple of seconds here to outline some of the actions EPA is undertaking to reduce pesticide exposure and risk to pollinators. Our goal here has always been to pursue efforts to take into account both the critical role that bees play in pollinating crops, as well as the important role of pesticides, including insecticides, play in controlling pests for overall agricultural health as well. Working with beekeepers, growers, pesticide applicators, and pesticide and seed companies, as well as state lead agencies and extension services at USDA, we're advancing new equipment and formulation technologies, performance standards or best management practices, and enforceable pesticide use instructions that can help avoid pesticide exposure to bees when they are foraging. And this is key. We are also sharing best practices with beekeepers on the use of pesticides to control mites in their colonies. With our partners, we're finding ways to minimize the release of pesticide-contaminated dust during planting. New planting technologies are being field tested, and this growing season and should become widely available next year. This is good news. In the meantime, implementing the BMPs we already know about will continue to progress. In addition, we're currently working with USDA to establish a web-based venue so that we can share these evolving BMPs with a wide audience. We know that education on these matters is pretty important, and that's true in most cases, and certainly when it comes to honeybee health. That's why EPA is also collaborating with the state agencies and the North American Pollinator Campaign to advance education and training modules in pesticide applicator certification courses. We know that enforcement is important. Later this month, EPA will issue new enforcement guidance to federal, state, and tribal enforcement officials to enhance investigations of bee kill incidents. We are also continuing outreach to stakeholders to ensure all are aware of the many ways they can report bee kill incidents to EPA. This is obviously critical information that we get so we can understand better what's happening. Finally, let me also mention that we are implementing new data requirements and risk assessment approaches for pollinators. These are new advances in our analytical capability, and they're based on public and external scientific peer review processes that were held last fall in 2012. And they reflect a collaborative effort between experts in California, Canada, Europe, and both the U.S., including both regulatory authorities and scientists. These new techniques of analysis will ensure studies that we do and others do will do a more thorough job of assessing the sublethal effects of pesticides on all life stages of honeybees, as well as the effects on colony health in field settings. Let me just finish, because I think we've really summarized this here, to reiterate EPA's commitment to working with this entire range of partners to implement everything we can to effectively address the complex and varied stressors facing pollinators in the country. This report really lays out a roadmap, and we're anxious to work with our partners on it. So thank you all again for being on the call.
And thank you, Acting Administrator Bob Perciasepe. And we now go to Dr. May Birenbaum. She is from the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. May, good morning.
Hi, thank you. I've been involved in honeybee health issues since chairing the National Research Council Committee on the Status of Pollinators, which released its report in October 2006, coincident with the initial reports of what came to be known as colony collapse disorder. This committee found that in cases where pollinator declines could be documented, possible causative factors included parasites and pathogens, pesticides, and habitat degradation. In the earliest scientific response to CCD in 2007, these factors were identified as the most plausible hypotheses for testing. Since then, the collective body of research resulting from an unprecedented effort by the scientific community supplementing traditional approaches with brand new genome-enabled tools and more sophisticated chemical and behavioral assays indicates that bee decline cannot unambiguously be linked to a single causative factor. And this is despite the fact that media outlets have on multiple occasions declared that the mystery has been solved and is attributable to a single factor, different in each case. The scientific consensus, consistently reinforced by empirical and epidemiological studies, is that multiple factors interact to cause decline. The main outcome of 5 years of accumulated new knowledge is that we now know a lot more about what we don't know. Although early on there was the hope that a single mortality agent would be identified that could be dispatched with a magic bullet, that's clearly not a plan that's justified based on the available science. A lot more information is needed, and we're not really well equipped or even used to fighting on multiple fronts. Characterizing the additive and synergistic interactions among mortality factors is essential for designing a long-term solution. As well, it's become increasingly clear that honeybees are not like most other insects, and for studies to be reliable enough to guide policy, they must be designed to reflect the complex realities of honeybee social behavior. In the interim, with the knowledge base already assembled, it is possible to design best management practices that can minimize risks from all of the interacting factors. You've heard on this call already, some of them are being implemented. There is no quick fix, though. Patching one hole in a boat that leaks from everywhere isn't going to stop it from sinking. The goal is to keep the boat afloat and not just slow the sinking, and that really means continuing to rely on the collective available data. Thanks.
Thank you, Dr. May Birenbaum, for joining us. And also on the phone lines is Zach Browning. He is a fourth-generation official beekeeper. Zach, good morning.
Good morning, and thank you. I'd like to thank EPA and USDA, especially for pulling this effort together. As a commercial beekeeper with operations in several states, I was pleased to be a part of the stakeholders conference, and I think that beekeepers will be pleased that the report focuses in on the major factors in honeybee health and decline. The report really makes it fairly clear that bee decline is complicated, but it is not a mystery. It's really about colony stress, and the report does a good job of breaking down the known major stresses into four categories: pests and pathogens, pesticide exposure, nutrition, and genetics. The report also indicates that the relationship between healthy bees and unhealthy bees is generally associated with multiple stressors. And the same, the solutions are also going to be multifaceted and involve many, many different stakeholders. We face a critical challenge. 70% of the crops that we rely on for our food supply are pollinated mainly by honeybees. Modern agriculture systems that rely on honeybees are very productive and efficient in terms of yield per acre, but that efficiency has come at some cost. Since the 50s, the average farm size in America has grown from about 200 acres to about 400 today. Well, average crop yields have increased 2- and 3-fold. On the other hand, honeybee colonies have decreased from about 5.5 million at the same time to 2.4 million today, while honey production per colony has steadily declined. This year, there's roughly 370 million acres of cultivated land in the lower 48 states. And this year, 96 million of those acres will be planted in corn. Cornfields are of no value to honeybees nutritionally. Honeybees obtain their food, primarily pollen and nectar, from plants. Like every other animal, if they can't find clean, nutritious food in abundance, then they are generally healthier than animals who cannot. Modern agriculture, particularly monoculture, is extremely tough on honeybee colonies. Often honeybees are concentrated in large groups to perform crop pollinations, and this practice allows pests and pathogens to spread from hive to hive and region to region very, very easily. Monocrops often offer only one source of food to bees, and that source may be contaminated by pesticides. We are losing suitable habitat for honeybees at unsustainable rates. In just the last 5 years, we have lost over 10 million acres of conservation land, mostly to commodity farming. And at the same time, while we may be using less pesticides by weight and perhaps less acutely toxic products, there are few commodity crop acres that are not treated with these products. As there is less diversity on the landscape, the potential for exposure is amplified, especially as bees are also concentrated, as they are asked to do more and more in terms of pollinating crops, as that demand continues to rise, while the supply of bees is steadily declining. What we need is becoming clearer. We need an abundance of clean, nutritious forage for bees. We need better pesticide practices and policies. We need tools to manage pests and disease. And we need genetic stocks that give us the advantages and more resilient strains to pests and pathogens. But how we accomplish these goals is the real challenge. One thing is clear. It will involve all stakeholders in the honeybee industry, government, agriculture, communities, chemical industries, academia, and others. If we can pull it together, I think we have a good chance of using the tools outlined in this report to bring back healthy honeybees and sustain our food supply going into the future. Thank you.
And thank you, Zach. Zach Browning, he's a fourth-generation official beekeeper. He'll be joining us for the Q&A session along with Dr. May Birenbaum, who is with the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. And at this time, we'd like to thank both the director of USDA's NEPA, Dr. Sunny Ramaswamy, as well as the acting administrator of EPA, Bob Purchaseppi, for joining us this morning. They'll be stepping out and coming in for the Q&A, along with Zach and May, is Jeff Pettis of USDA, and Jim Jones and Steve Bradbury of EPA, all technical experts, all providing various answers and combining their expertise to answer your questions on the phone lines. And a reminder to you reporters and members of the media, if you do have a question for any of our guests, you can please press star 1 on your telephone touch tone pad. And let's go to the phone lines, and our first call of the day belongs to Seth Borenstein of the Associated Press. Seth, good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for doing this. I guess this is more for Jim. It's too bad Bob has disappeared. The two top officials have disappeared. For the top EPA and USDA officials who are left, in terms of the lack of emphasis in this report on pesticide, that seems to be in direct conflict with what is happening in Europe. And I'm wondering, do you feel that Europe is going more against the science, or are you, I mean, why are you Europe and you looking at the same science and coming up with different answers? You know, them blaming neonicotinoids, you guys saying it's a whole mix of everything. So I guess the big question is, why the de-emphasis on pesticides, and what do you think about the European emphasis on pesticides?
Hi, this is Jim Jones from EPA. So, I don't believe that the report de-emphasizes pesticides. I think what we did with our colleagues from USDA was to bring together the expertise around the issues that are affecting pollinator health, bee health in the United States. We had a wide range of expertise from around the country, academia, NGO community, government, and it was the advice of the experts that led us to the conclusions that we are announcing today, that there are a range of factors that impact bee health. So, you know, we had a process here that was very inclusive, that was very science-driven, and we're reporting out the results of that science as as that consensus evolved, and that's what we're talking about today.
Let's go to John Broder of the New York Times with the next call. John, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for doing this. I want to follow up on Seth's question. Whether you emphasize or de-emphasize pesticide use, the Europeans, perhaps, you know, just out of caution or wanting to act quickly, have banned this one class of pesticides. Why not just do that or take steps to take action, even if you don't know all of the stress factors and how they interact? You know that pesticides are one of them, and that's something you can act on. Why not?
Hi, it's Jim Jones again.
Right.
From EPA. So just to be clear, the Europeans have not banned the three pesticides that you're referring to. They're in the middle of a process right now that could lead to such an outcome, but they have not actually taken that action. We're just going to have to monitor that situation to see what they actually do. As a general matter, we at the EPA let science drive the outcome of our decision-making here, and to us it's very important that we get the science correct. That is not just because we strictly adhere to just science in some kind of an abstract way. There are non-trivial costs to society if we get this wrong. These are products that not only provide meaningful benefits to the farmers who use them, but they then generate benefits to consumers as well for affordable food in the United States. And they also are compounds that, as a general matter, for human health and the environment, are preferable to the alternative. So, as a matter of policy, we've let the science lead our regulatory decision making, and we want to make sure that we make accurate and appropriate regulatory decisions as opposed to things that could lead to meaningful societal costs without providing any benefits whatsoever.
And let's go back to the phone lines. And just a reminder before we do, that our technical experts, please identify yourself as you're answering your questions. We have Ann Thompson back on the line with NBC News. Ann, unmute your line. We should take care of that, and you're welcome to ask your question to our guest.
Thank you. If I could only use my phone. I just want to follow up on what Seth and John said, because, you know, I've been talking to beekeepers, and they say increasingly in this country, because of big agriculture production and the monocrop production that that Zach spoke of, there isn't a safe place to raise bees anymore. And then I spoke to another scientist who says he's identified 150 different chemical residues in the bee colonies that he's looked at. So wouldn't that point to, among other things, that pesticides are a huge problem? And isn't there more that should be done looking into this to stop the bees from declining? That, and how close are we in a crisis situation with honeybees? Are we at the point or nearing the point where we may not be able to pollinate enough crops to produce the amount of food that we need to? Thank you.
Maybe Zach, can you address the issue about whether we're running out of bees?
I can take the second part. So this is Zach, and speaking specifically about whether or not we've got enough pollinator supply for the crop demand. is really an issue of timing. There are certain periods where there's a very high demand for honeybees, where we are nearing or perhaps even beyond our capacity to fulfill, and specifically relating to almond pollination early in the winter in California, where hive numbers are naturally at their lowest through the course of the winter, we have really come close to exceeding our ability to cover that crop. And then moving further into the year, I mean, we're starting to see that there are times when we don't have enough, or at least prices would indicate that there is not enough supply, especially in years where colony losses are high, like this past year. There is some concern whether there's enough bees for blueberries in Maine, as I understand. So we're on the brink. I don't know that we've crossed that threshold yet, but we're certainly getting there very fast.
And this is May Barenbaum. If I can address the pesticide issue, just to emphasize two points that were made. Not all pesticides are neonicotinoids. And as Anne, the reporter from NBC, mentioned, studies of residues have documented the presence of over 100 different pesticides and metabolites. It is an incredibly complex situation. Pulling out one pesticide does not remove the others. They're not all the result of agricultural exposure. Some of the pesticides, the residues most frequently encountered are acaricides, pesticides used by beekeepers to control the varroa mite, which is the vector or carrier of many of the viral diseases that also affect honeybees. So it's not a simple matter of just removing pesticides, because it's a very complex situation, and there are interactions, synergistic interactions among pesticides that also make it difficult to predict what the effect will be of removing only a single one of 100 different contaminants.
This is Sonny Ramaswamy. I just wanted to add the third part of the question that Ann Thompson asked was, what should we be doing? And really, this report that has been put out offers us a path forward, a roadmap, as it were. And we at USDA, and I know both my own agency, the National Institute of Food and Agriculture, and the Agricultural Research Service, and Animal and Plant Health Inspection Service, all the components of USDA are committed to making sure that if there's additional science that needs to be done, additional research that needs to be done, additional education that needs to be done, we're committed to it. And like the rest of the country, we're very deeply interested in finding out what the reasons are and making sure that we deploy the absolute best science to be able to address those questions.
Reporters and members of the media, this reminder, if you have a question for any of our guests, and we do have several to answer your questions today, please press star 1 on your telephone touch-tone pad. We now return to the phone lines. Bill Thompson of Wall Street Journal joins us with the next question. Good morning, Bill.
Yeah, hi. I suppose a question for Mr. Brown. I'd like to sort of get some how many bees have you seen die off this winter? And is your situation consistent with colony collapse disorder, or has there been a progression? Are you seeing a different pace to the die-offs?
So it's Zach Browning, and the answer to the question is that in my own operation, my losses were just about double what they were in the previous year, comparing 2012 losses to 2013 losses. And the symptoms that we saw were not consistent necessarily with all of the symptoms of colony collapse disorder. We feel that a lot of the losses that we had came from multiple factors. We identified the drought to be a consistent factor in stressing the bees in the fall, and we tried to react to that, as did many beekeepers. We had losses that were the direct result of exposure to pesticide. We had losses that were considered natural due to to queen failures, and we also had hives that were succumbing to dearth, and that's the result of the drought, and that's also the result of poor nutrition. But all of these things have impacted colonies, and those operations that I'm aware of consistently had deaths that were related to mite loads and pesticide, and as well as drought-related factors. And so it's more of a myriad of factors and a combination of those factors interacting that have caused more of the decline, I think, in recent years, beyond just those that were associated with colony collapse disorder. And the system just isn't supporting the bees the way it used to, in that there's not the habitat, and what is left on the periphery is not enough of a buffer to keep the pesticide and other contaminants out of their food and out of their hives.
And our final question of the day belongs to Josephine Marcotti of the Minneapolis Star Tribune. Josephine, good morning.
Hi, thank you. So every trend in agriculture seems to be working against the near-term solutions that you propose. Corn acres are accelerating. Farmers out here are planting right up to the roads. There's been an enormous loss of CRP and other conservation land. How are any of the recommendations that you suggest that you're suggesting address those trends?
This is Sonny. I wonder, Jeff. Jeff Pettis.
Sure. This is Jeff Pettis with Agricultural Research Service. That's actually one of the few things that we point out in the report that almost everyone can get behind, and that is that if we had better available forage for bees and other pollinators, honeybees and other pollinators, we'd go a long way towards improving pollinator health. And I think there's some programs that are already in place. The Farm Bill had pollinator-friendly language 5 years ago, and we were implementing that. But we're looking across other agencies, Bureau of Land Management, Department of Defense, other lands that might be utilized as refuges for pollinators. So I think there is a government-wide effort to try to move that forward, and it's the one area that we know we can make immediate progress. But I agree with you. Modern farming practices are leaving very little land for bees and other pollinators at this moment.
And reporters, thank you for your questions today and for all of you in listening in to today's broadcast. And to all of our guests, thank you for participating. This is Rod Bain from the